Tuesday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Going to get through some games here, which we are long overdue for. Nice slate tonight. A big matchup in the West between the Kings and Nuggets. Also, two of the league's best teams, San Antonio and Toronto, in what ended up being a very comfortable win for the Spurs. And then also, anytime Minnesota and Philly match up, Karl Towns and Joel Embiid. I think you got to do that game. So that's where we want to start momentarily. But first, we're going to do a set of four random questions. This is a gimmick Danny and I do from time to time. We each come up with two questions. We have not shared them with one another. We literally came up with them in a 2-minute period before we started recording this podcast at 1:30 a.m. Pacific time tonight. And I also would be remiss if I didn't mention we are sponsored today by SeatGeek. You can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via the CapSpace code, which will get you a rebate. So Danny, would you like to start with your first question of the evening?
Sure. I'll mention that my two questions are very similar, but they're on different subjects, so it'll make sense. But the first one, we'll start out east, which is outside of the top four teams in terms of records, so Cavs, Raptors, Celtics, and Hornets, what team do you trust the most? And I was thinking about this more in terms of like who do you trust the most to make the playoffs, but you can define it kind of however you want.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because trust the most to make the playoffs, that means that they're just going to be somewhat consistent. Let me take a look at the projections here real quick. So the Bulls are out. I just don't think they're that good. They can't shoot. Not a fan of them, really. Maybe they'll turn around with Rondo, but they still have a lot of structural problems. Pistons are crazy right now. Knicks in free fall. Magic, not too into them either. I think it really comes down, and the Bucks, while I think they are going to do well, they've played well, they're actually projected now to finish ahead of the Hornets at the number four seed. I still can't say that I trust them quite yet, just because you have so many young guys in this team who have been playing over their head. Do you trust like Jabari Parker to keep shooting 37% on threes when he hasn't hit them before? Is Malcolm Brogdon going to keep playing this well? Those sorts of things. Can Giannis keep playing at this level? So while I like the Bucks, I wouldn't say that I trust them as much. So that leaves Pacers and Hawks. Hawks might trade someone. So despite my better judgment, the Indiana Pacers. But yeah, that is a hard question, because there's really nobody that pops out to you at first. I guess it would just be the Pacers, because they have guys who've been there before. They have talent. And yeah, I think while they're not spectacular, it's hard to see them just completely falling off.
I struggled with it too. I ended up with the Bucks, just because they've been solid on offense and defense. And so I figure that even if one of those falls off, the other one should be okay. Whereas I just absolutely don't trust the Hawks offense. You know, like they're each one of those teams kind of has a, not a fatal flaw, but a flaw that is certainly relevant. And so that's how I ended up with the Bucks, but it made me a little bit queasy.
Yeah. And I may regret not picking the Bucks, but I still think that they, while they have been the best of these teams so far in terms of net rating and their projection, 86% chance of making the playoffs right now, after that nice win against Oklahoma City at home last night, I still wonder, and especially just to a young team in close games, you wonder about that aspect of it as well. They've kind of pissed away some close games late this year too, or come close to it. All right, my first question, who would you rank as the bottom three coaches in the NBA right now?
That's interesting, because there aren't any, you know, there were some kind of ideas that was floating around about how there aren't really any coaches that were obviously like going to get fired this year. And there also aren't many coaches that are, you know, justifiably like disappointing in that way.
Yeah, there are a lot of new coaches now, and it's tough to say that we have the book open on them. I think, and there aren't any where I'm like, oh man, these guys are just awful. A lot
like,
of them have been
like
dealt
Watson. I think Watson's definitely on that list for me.
It's more to me guys who haven't necessarily shown anything positive, as opposed to they've shown so much negative,
which is great. And that also is a sign that there are fewer retreads around the league. Like that's one of the things I like the most about somebody like Fizdale getting a chance, and I think he's done a good job reaching the Grizzlies. I'm still concerned. I don't know if he's all the way on this list. I'm still concerned about Malone. He got really mad after this game, and like he talked about their lack of veteran leadership and that their team is just overwhelmingly veterans. Tom Zeller had a nice theory on that about how the it might be also that he's just mad that he's never beaten the Kings since they fired him.
Yeah, but that's got to be a little vexing, but
it certainly does. And
this is a big playoff game. I mean, they've lost three straight now after they were in playoff position, and so I understand his frustration. But yeah, it's clearly killing him to kind of have to play this way. I think that's kind of how the front office wants wants to play, which, and I agree with them that we're going to play with Jokic at center. We're going to play small. But yeah, I mean, really going to be tough to stop people with some of these units that they're running out there. And that obviously boils Malone's blood. I wouldn't put him quite in that group, though. I would say, I mean, I don't think that team is underachieved at all. I thought they did well last year to get to the 34 wins. I mean, so who's your three? I'll let you answer first.
I think the other one would be McMillan. I've just never been the biggest fan of his utilization of talent, and the Pacers have been shaky on defense. I don't think they've underperformed at their talent level on that end, but I haven't loved the jobs he's done in recent years.
Yeah, to me, I think the ones that pop out, Earl Watson, is they have a really low assist rate there. They've never defended. Granted, they have a lot of young guys, but they have some vets. I haven't thought that they've been particularly creative offensively. Brett Brown just has never really shown anything at all. Like, this is now what, his fourth year, and there's just not a ton there in terms of resume other than one year when they were really good defensively. And yeah, I mean, it's tough for him because he's been handed a really difficult situation, but there's no evidence that he can make more of that than you would necessarily expect. Fred Hoiberg in Chicago, kind of a similar situation where he has not been given a roster that can play the way he wants to play. You know, they've had one of the few teams really that starts a traditional four, Taj Gibson. That's not really how he wanted to play. They brought in Rondo and Wade. I mean, this is not at all a roster that fits with him. He's tried to adapt, but again, not really much that you can see. Some of his rotations still, he usually seems to figure it out eventually, but he's gone long stretches of playing really unworkable front court combinations. Noah and Gibson last year, Mirotic and Gasol last year, this year Bobby Portis and Mirotic off the bench playing Portis over Cristiano Felicio for a time, and you know, not giving any time at all to a lineup without a point guard this year. He just started posting up Doug McDermott for the first time in the last two games when he was a dominant college post scorer, and he gets guarded by point guards all the time. This team has been desperate for offense. Yeah, you don't see a ton of really sexy stuff out of there. And they defended okay, I think, in large part in line with their talent level. Who else did I have that was on this list? Yeah, McMillan, I think, is a good one. I didn't consider him just because they haven't been that bad. But yeah, another guy who, you know, what has he shown you recently, especially?
You convinced me. Hoiberg's on my list now.
Yeah.
Malone has been fine. I was having trouble, but Hoiberg's a good choice. And also, he doesn't appear to be reaching the guys just on a fundamental level. Like, you've heard the little revolt stuff last year and then more this year. So that's always a concern.
I mean, if you want to talk about simply the job that they've done so far this year, does Tom Thibodeau have to be on this list? I mean, obviously he has a great track record. I'm not putting him on there overall, but if you're just going to rank only the jobs that guys have done this year, he's got to be by the bottom.
At the same point though, is it possible that it's just that some of these Wolves guys are incorrigible?
It's quite possible too. Yeah. But I think just the way he's been using Karl Towns is the biggest problem to me. Not getting anything out of Tyus Jones, not really getting anything out of Muhammad. Like, these are guys who actually have had success at times and had success in ways that were very reproducible, and you just have not really seen him go to any of these lineups.
Not to spoil some of our own stuff for a little bit later, but I get this residual bitterness when he often starts the second quarter with Cole Aldrich and Bielitsa at the four and the five, and I'm like, why can't you do this the rest of the time? I just get so frustrated because it's like, okay, you're using this at the time when it's not least valuable, but less valuable than if you went to it more often earlier.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anyone else who would be in this discussion. Yeah, I don't think so at this point.
I'm sure someone mentioned Gentry, but I think he's done a fine job, and they're defending relatively well this year.
Yeah, Gentry would have to be in the discussion. But yeah, the way they've improved defensively this year, I think you can get him off this list for now. You know, we'll see at the end of the year. It might happen. All right, wow, this is going well here. What's your next one?
The three teams that I consider the worst in the West all won tonight: the Mavericks, the Lakers, and the Suns. How do you think, knowing what we know now, how do you think, in what order do you think they finish the season?
Oh, I think the Mavs will be the highest of those easily. I would say Suns last, Lakers second to last.
That's how I settled on it too, but it could be close.
The Mavs could finish with a better record than the Wolves, I think. I mean, they have an identical record to the Wolves, and Dirk is back now. They've got, you know, they're getting healthy. Carlisle is a good coach. They're going to push. The Wolves may end up really kind of shutting it down more towards the end. So And yeah, I think the Mavs, just even now with this hobbled version of Dirk Nowitzki, having him out there is pretty remarkable what he does for an offense. I mean, we saw it in that Warriors game, just even for brief stretches. It's pretty incredible when teams are not willing to leave him in a pick and pop situation, what you can get done.
Yep.
All right, my last one here. What team do you look at as a sleeping giant? And we'll say that in the sense that they are a candidate to play way better than the record that they have amassed so far. Or maybe not even better, more than their record, their net rating, any of these things.
Well, because if it's record, I think Utah is the team that just lingers there, that they could be a lot better than they are.
Yeah. Although they are already in fourth in the West right now, so.
I don't know why I still believe in the Pelicans, but I would say the Pelicans and the Wizards are teams that I just see that they could rattle off and be, let's say, five or six games over 500 the rest of the way, and that wouldn't surprise me completely. I don't expect it, but it's certainly possible. Whereas I don't feel that way with any kind of the other teams in the middle, unless the Hawks really figure it out.
I think the Celtics are 21-14. I think they'll have a little bit better percentage than that the rest of the way. The Jazz are 22-14 right now. I think they can do a little bit better. The Blazers, I would say the Blazers. I mean, if you look at what their defensive rating
they
is.
They better.
If you look at what their defensive rating is with Aminu on the floor, it's actually pretty respectable. It's like about mid-pack, like in the 104 range. And as long as they can stay healthy, get Lillard back soon, I think they can at least defend semi-competently. And this is always going to be a top 10 offense. So they're 15-21 right now. They also have had a brutal December schedule that gets a lot easier in January. They had a couple of real nice wins of late at home against the Kings, and then on the road against the Wolves, both of those without Lillard. So I think that they would probably be my pick in the East.
I have one more.
Who is it?
The Sixers. I think that they could actually win some games if they can get Simmons back and play with the purpose they did in the first half of this game. I think they could win some. I'm not sure that they will, but they could.
Yeah, I mean, if the Embiid minutes restriction goes up again, that's going to help you too.
And if Nerlens Noel plays, because he's actually legitimately good at playing basketball.
Yeah. All right, we'll get to that game in a moment here. But first, this from SeatGeek. Golden State Warriors tickets are quite expensive. My girlfriend is a big Warriors fan. I usually cover all the Warriors home games, so I can't sit with her. But they are going to be playing against the Kings next month, and so we're going to look for tickets on SeatGeek. The biggest attraction of SeatGeek is just convenience. You don't have to put in any weird, like, CAPTCHA, prove you're not a robot. It's all right there on your phone. Very easy to figure out. They aggregate together ticket buying sites, so you don't have to worry about going to six different sites, and then if you don't find the deal you want, or you find one, you're worried that maybe it's a few bucks better at a bunch of other sites. You don't have to worry about that now. They're bringing them all together for you. And then they also rank the tickets by value, so you don't have to compare, all right, section 101 third row versus section 103 fifth row, which one is the better value. One of them's $30, one's $40. SeatGeek actually now tells you really what you're getting by ranking all the tickets by value. So you can trust their algorithms. You can trust that they're giving you the options. You just go in there, you pick the best value in the area that you want to sit, and you're done. So much easier than spending. I used to spend like a half hour trying to buy tickets for an event, comparing everything. And now it goes from 30 minutes to 30 seconds with SeatGeek. Best of all, you can let them know that you came from us. And more importantly, for your purposes, get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via the familiar CapSpace code. You go into the settings tab on that free SeatGeek app, click on add a promo code, put in CapSpace, all one word. Remember, we talk about that all the time on the program. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. So that's the CapSpace code and the free SeatGeek app. All right, so since we were already on the subject, really, let's get to this crazy Philly-Minnesota game. At one point, Philly led it 68-42. Then Jahlil Okafor came in the game, and they gave up a 17-2 run immediately. to the Wolves' credit, we'll talk about the first half, too, where Philly built that lead. But to the Wolves' credit, they basically went to a Rubio pick-and-roll with Towns every time during that 17-2 run. Rubio was drawing just enough help, finding shooters on the weak side. They never actually made him shoot the ball in those pick and rolls, but nonetheless, he knows how to operate out of that set. Even if he doesn't have the explosion that he had before that ankle injury, the man could throw a pass and find shooters. It was very impressive what they're able to do during that period, but pretty much the rest of the time, pretty ugly for this Minnesota team.
That first quarter in particular was a lot of good for the Sixers and bad for the Wolves, and they were pretty inexorably intertwined. You couldn't really separate on certain possessions, like, oh, the Sixers are looking really good, but oftentimes when a team this shaky looks that good, it requires a lot of help.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Embiid was dominant early on, then cooled off a little bit late. He's still, the role that he's being asked to play is still a little bit too high, especially just with the straight up ISO post-ups. Those can get stale a little bit, but he's still their best option for creating offense at this point. And he ended up going 8 out of 20 from the field, only 5 of 11 at the rim, but a couple of those were just plays that he was able to tap back in. And then he was 1 out of 3 on three pointers. The matchup between he and Towns in the post, they basically both just kept stopping each other late in the game as they posted up. The defense seemed to be a little bit ahead of the offense, and Embiid in the post with his back to the basket really is supposed to have this great footwork. He's not really able to fake guys out with his back to the basket. He likes to turn and face, and he's very effective with just that jab step pull up jumper. He's a guy that you really got to make him put the ball on the floor in those situations, and he can kind of overpower guys. He also made some really nice passes in this game, had 3 assists, but also a number of plays where he really set things up for others that they just missed. I think that the next real thing that he can develop is just a turnaround jumper with that great touch where he just is going to back down and then just turn over his right shoulder to the baseline. And even a jump hook, you don't see a ton of that from him either. He's so big and strong that he should be able to have plays where he's not going to go to like the great footwork. He's just going to back down into position and then use his touch to shoot right over guys.
Those also can create good passing looks because it can be a quicker action. And so you use that. And if you freak out another guy and want him to come earlier, then you just make that pass. The threat will be very useful for him.
Andrew Wiggins, on the other hand, really struggled in this one. 2 of 15 from the field, mostly on a bevy of mid-range jump shots.
He also had a couple of bad turnovers. There was one where he basically just drove into a crowd and the ball went off his own knee. And guys are going to have bad nights. Like, some of these were just missed shots, just that a couple of, especially with the above the break threes, were just shots that didn't go in that oftentimes do. I mean, we talked early in the season about how how his 3-point shooting was revelation. But in the interior, a lot of that stuff was just, they were just hard shots and they weren't going in. And you saw the difference. And of course, some of this is, you have to kind of say that it's just the nature of their usage. But Levine, his shots felt more natural in the flow of everything than Wiggins. And you need somebody to sop up some of your bad shots, and Wiggins does a lot of that, but I think he sops up more bad shots than they need because they can just work harder to create better looks.
Yeah, for Wiggins, 1 out of 7 from mid-range, 1 out of 3 at the rim, 0 for 2 in floater range. A lot of these were some really bad long twos. I will give him some credit, though, that he threw some nice passes in this game when he was double-teamed in the post. And one of the things that I really was harping on during the game is both he and Towns would throw passes to usually it was Jang when he was on the floor. And yeah, that's, you know, Jang is a great mid-range shooter, but it's a long two. You can, A, it's only worth 2, and B, you can close that shot down a lot more easily, right? Like, there are a bunch of plays where they'd be posted up and throw it to Jang 20 feet from the basket on the weak side, or another one where they would run a pick and roll or a pick and pop. Towns would get it at the top, drive in, and Ilyasova, who was guarding Jang, he would step all the way in for a charge. Towns makes the right pass. Jang wide open on the baseline, drains the shot. Yeah, it's only worth 2, though. You know, like, it's just, and you're not going to make that shot often enough for it to really be a good shot. In a normal NBA offense, that's a guy in the corner. And Jang, actually, maybe he can get to the point where he is making that corner three, but probably not the above the break three for a while yet. And whether it's his lack of talent in that area, whether it's Tom Thibodeau not telling him the right place to stand, whether it's just that they don't have somebody else who can make that shot. I mean, their problems at the four are well documented. It really puts a crimp in their offense, especially when you also consider the fact that Rubio can't shoot either.
It also is a lower value play in terms of the other potential positives, because all that's going to happen is he's going to happily take that long two. So you don't have a chance of generating foul. You don't have a chance of generating a good look for somebody, maybe a three or a layup or a foul for somebody else. And part of that also gets into an idea, having covered a couple of coaching changes with the Warriors, about one of the biggest implements that Coach Kerr had with them was the idea of expectations and the idea that you can work and get a better shot than that. And the Wolves have not reached that point yet. And it could just be that they're young and they're still figuring all this out. But at some point, they're going to need to take out, cut the fat from their expectations, because then even then, if they expect a little bit more out of their offense, they can get it.
Maybe. I maybe feel a little bit differently just because there's so many guys that you can help off on this team that it's like, if you have an open look that's even semi-open, you probably better take it. Now, if it's a Wiggins long two off the dribble with 16 on the shot clock, yeah, I got you. But if it's a three, if it's a decent look for one of their good players, you know, I don't mind them taking it as much. But I see your point that they still, the shot selection is not great on this team, but it can be hard because I think a lot of times when they pass up looks, there's so much help around the court that nothing ever opens up again. You know, it's not necessarily a case where, hey, if you move the ball, this guy can hit the shot, or keep the train rolling until we get, you know, go from good shot to great shot, because guys are going to record scratch, guys are going to get helped off of when the next guy drives and have no one to throw it to, that kind of thing.
Speaking of help, I was surprisingly impressed with how well the Noel Embiid tandem worked, in part just because Nerlens Noel can help in a way that a lot of their other guys can't defensively, because he's just this unusual combination of instincts and physical ability.
Yeah, and Embiid can shoot the ball a little bit. It wasn't, and they can get down the floor. It's more of an offensive problem, I think. And you can also say maybe a little bit of a waste of Noel's skills, but he had one play that I tweeted out at Nate Duncan NBA. You can follow me there, where Zach LaVine drove from the three-point line on the left wing. Nerlens was basically standing, you know, a foot in from the three-point line when LaVine started his drive on the opposite wing, guarding Bielitsa, and he managed to get all the way to the rim in front of LaVine and go up two hands, verticality, not foul. LaVine made an incredible shot over him, but, you know, there's one or two bigs in the league that can make that play and actually get there, and LaVine is a fast guy, too, in a straight line. It was really a remarkable play. Nerlens also had some pretty dumb plays as well when he was in, like, where he just kind of spaced out and decided he was going to run after somebody who was dribbling up court and try and steal it, and then just gave up a dunk to Karl Towns in transition after a missed free throw on that play.
That one was really bad.
That was awful. But he had some nice dunks in his first quarter run when he was by himself. And, you know, I think that they can be very difficult to score on with Embiid and Noel in there. And Embiid, still his shot blocking, his defensive instincts are really outstanding as well.
On that note I wanted to mention is that particularly in that first quarter run, Noel ran the floor really hard. And yeah, the Sixers at this point are still shaky in so many parts of their offense, and, you know, the league's worst offense for a reason. If they can get a big, especially him, who can run the floor in transition, and they can force more stops, which ideally that group can, it adds another element to their offense, because they're going to struggle in the half court with their personnel. But if they can get let's say two or three more clean looks a game in transition, it would make a world of difference for them.
Yeah, it's just, the problem is, even if you wanted to play those guys together, that means you got to have a ton of spacing around them, which they don't have now. But they also have this guy named Ben Simmons who's going to start playing soon, and you can't play those three guys together for sure offensively. Like,
agreed. They had a little bit with Saric out there too. So,
and Saric is a four himself, you know?
Right. They don't need that.
He's been playing out of position at the three because they have nobody else.
But at least it's nice to know that you have it in case you need it. Like, that is an argument, whereas I haven't trusted the Embiid Okafor combination. I don't think you need to conceive of it that way, but at least it wasn't terrible. I think it was actually pretty interesting.
No, I agree. And maybe it's good enough that to the extent you feel like you need to showcase Noel, you can get him a few more minutes. I think it's pretty clear, though, that if their goal is to win right now, which it isn't, but and they need to keep Jahlil Okafor engaged if only for his own trade value as well, just not playing Okafor at all and having Noel and Embiid be the centers is the way to go, because for whatever reason, I mean, they played Okafor a little bit in the first half randomly. I mean, I don't know if there's some kind of a minutes limit still for Noel. I'm guessing probably not. He could probably handle the 20 minutes a game that Embiid is not going to play. And then when they went to Okafor in that third quarter, it was just completely disastrous on both ends, really. Okafor was bobbling passes. He looked, even the stuff that he's usually good at, he wasn't doing well. So I think clearly Noel at center during all the, he's better than Okafor at this point, especially when you consider some of the other limitations that they have on this team. And you have to wonder too, I mean, what is your thought on this? Like, should they just play the best guys? And you know what? Like, if it messes up Okafor's trade value, so what? You're not going to get that much for him anyway? Or should they still be trying to like show that he can play a little bit?
In the near term, let's say the next 2-3 weeks, I think you should focus more on Nerlens. He is, I think you can rehabilitate his value more quickly because he is good. And you can do that. You can win some games.
There is more time with Okafor too, which I'm sure is where you're going there.
Exactly. And so then with Okafor, the people who are on board with him aren't going to sour because of this stretch. And so maybe if you figure out what you have with Nerlens, what you want to do with him in these next 2-3 weeks, maybe even if you don't trade him at that point, you've already given everybody who can, maybe you can change their mind, enough of a sample. And then at that point you change it a little bit, and whether it's rehabilitating Okafor or actually just seeing if he can work in that, not from a rehabilitation standpoint, but just to kind of see how it all runs together, then that's certainly worth a shot.
Let me get to a few more notes on this one before we talk about the very end of the game. Stauskas was forced to play some backup one. Sergio Rodriguez is out with a sprained ankle. Chris Dunn made his life absolutely miserable. That is probably the last guy in the entire league necessarily you would want poor Sauce Castillo having to bring the ball up against. And he had a number of just ugly turnovers, drives where he decided to try and drive by his pressure. Dunn was pretty impressive defensively in this one in his 18 minutes. Still just a relative zero on offense. He did have that ridiculous move yesterday or on Sunday against the Blazers where he basically like threw the ball around one side of Shabazz Napier and went and got it by running around the other side. That was pretty sick. But other than that, continued to struggle. Also had 5 fouls, many of which he vehemently did not agree with in this one. Shabazz Muhammad had a nice game with 10 points on 3 of 6 shooting from the field, got to the foul line a little bit, hit his only three. He just had his left-handed hook working from the right block. He really likes to turn baseline for that sort of half hook floater. But they had some spacing around him, as you noted. That was nice to see him. And I still would like to see him get more time playing at the four. We've seen very little of that so far. And just because Bielitsa still is just not really been hitting a shot, and he doesn't really provide much more on defense than Shabazz does anyway, frankly. He executes a little bit better, but Shabazz is more athletic. So I still would like to see that unit that they ran out there against the Warriors in that game that they won in Oakland last year. Anything else that you took away from this one you wanted to talk about?
No, I think we've done a pretty good job with it. But of course, we have to talk about the ridiculous kind of like end sequence of this game.
Oh yeah, well there was one other sequence I want to talk about first that's going to kind of be lost by the wayside. It was 60-41, I think. Oh no, that was the other game, never mind, the Spurs Raptors game. No, it was 57-42 at halftime, and the Sixers scored the first 11 points of the third. That included 2 awful missed long twos from Wiggins. Embiid scored 2 buckets. Ilyasova hit a 3 in transition where Towns was just ran back to the lane. Ilyasova ran to the corner and Towns just didn't realize what was going on until Ilyasova was already making the 3. They actually were cross-matched in this game where Embiid was guarding Towns and then they had guarding Embiid on the other end. So that led to some funky matchups at times, but this one was pretty inexcusable. And then they also actually had a 5-second inbound violation on a made basket. Rubio goes to take the ball out of bounds because he just happened to be there. Towns runs all the way down. So does Jang. Those are the guys who usually take the ball out of bounds, according to Jim Peterson, the Wolves color guy, and they just got a 5-second violation because Wiggins tried to run back, but he actually got denied and they didn't call timeout in time. It was just that, who knows, that play could have cost them the game. They only ended up losing by 2.
Yeah, that's true. I lost in the shuffle is a good word for it, because I had forgotten that it happened, even though it stuck out to me at the time.
So the end of this game was really incredible. The Embiid-Towns matchup, these guys were really going at each other late. Karl Towns, probably not quite as physically dominant right at the basket as Embiid is in terms of his strength and his size, which is pretty remarkable because Towns is a pretty big dude. Started off with Embiid just stoning him on a couple of post-ups, and then Embiid dunked in on a post-up for a bucket. Embiid's finishing around the rim, still a little kind of rough, you know, doesn't really have much of a left-hand hook type of game, but, you know, he's big enough and strong enough and gets fouled enough that it still works okay. Then the next time down, Towns got 2 offensive rebounds in a row and then got a layup off of a pass. And then again, the next time Embiid was able to stop a Karl Towns drive and just force a jump ball. Really, it just a great battle between those guys. Embiid looked a little bit fresher down the stretch, having played less minutes. But even if it wasn't like incredibly beautiful basketball, they were both going really hard. And Towns, for his part, finished with 6 offensive rebounds, which is good to see from him. 5 assists as well for him, even though he was only 9 out of 22 for 23 points and really has not been hitting his jumper at all. He's 1 of 6 from 3 on largely open looks. And I think he's like 10 of his last 55 now or something like that, according to the broadcast.
I was intrigued throughout the fourth quarter in particular in this because Towns, one of his best strengths as an offensive player has been his ability to get centers out of their comfort zone and then drive past them. He's been had a few just gorgeous ones, even had some on power forwards, including one on Zach Randolph where he just made him look bad. That didn't happen very much in this game because I think Embiid just, the way that they approached it was to let him drive a little bit more and to kind of snare him in at that point, and I thought it worked reasonably well. Granted, most teams don't have
Joel
Embiid.
Part of that, too, was Ilyasova is a really good, he's more of an overhelper at sometimes, as we saw in the tying three, but he will drop off of his guy and get in the lane and try and take charges and force you to pass the ball. And they also really double teamed a lot as well, Philly did, against the Wolves post up guys, whether it was Wiggins or Towns.
Yeah, and they didn't very much on Muhammad, but that's a different thing.
A couple of other plays that stood out: Rubio, after Embiid tried to throw a pass to a cutting Stauskas when he was like triple covered under the lane, Rubio got the steal. And he threw one of the best passes you'll ever see, a hit ahead to Levine, who was streaking ahead, made the and one layup, but then missed the free throw. The Sixers got a little bit of a rough whistle late when they just called Embiid for just chucking Towns, but you know, it was maybe like slightly a foul, but not really, 20 feet from the basket when Towns wasn't even really trying to post up. A little bit of a dubious call. And then they were in the bonus, and Bielitsa got 2 free throws with 40 seconds left when he was just fouled on a drive by Ersan Ilyasova. Again, 20 feet from the basket, not a shooting foul, but that call put him in the bonus to get him within 3. And then TJ McConnell blew past Karl Towns on a pick and roll switch and just made a floater over him, which was a tough shot, but I mean, Karl, just get in a stance, letting TJ McConnell blow by you like that. It wasn't even really a switch, it was kind of he stepped up, but TJ McConnell is not going to pull up for the 3 in your eye. If you just get into a stance, you can slide with that guy and make his life a lot more difficult. So that wasn't very impressive,
especially if you're Karl Anthony Towns. Like it isn't even a circumstance. Like, there are slower guys that can do that. And before that moment, this felt a lot like a Nuggets game to me, where it's just sitting there going, okay, how are the Sixers going to blow it? And as soon as he made that shot, I'm like, oh, maybe they're actually going to pull this out. And that is sort of what ended up happening, though it was kind of the Wolvesing it up a little bit too.
So then they tried for the quick 2. They ran Andrew Wiggins off an Iverson cut, which, if you are a new listener, that's the cut that Allen Iverson popularized, where you basically run from one wing to the other, catch the ball, rip it through and drive to the basket on a pass from the top. He did that, drove into about 3 guys, and at the last moment threw a nice pass out to Levine, had Towns wide open. They swung it to Towns wide open the top for 3, and he just missed it. But they were able to get the 2-for-1. Karl Towns then blocked Embiid when he attempted to face up and go baseline. And in what was a little controversial to me, they granted a advance of the ball, despite the fact that Towns outletted the ball immediately. Once you make that pass or dribble, you're supposed to not be able to advance the ball. Maybe Tibbs called the timeout that early, but for him to have reacted that quickly and the ref to have blown his whistle that quickly, it struck me as a little dubious. So Minnesota got a nice little gift there. And then it was just terrible defense by the Sixers, Ilyasova specifically, on that tying Rubio 3. I get it that Rubio is supposed to not be the greatest shooter, but you're up 3, like, guard people at the 3-point line. There's no reason to be standing under the basket.
You have one job. That one job. And it's also hilarious because Rubio, while he is a shaky shooter, he's made a few of these strange, like, you see him get the ball and you go, oh no, it was one against the Thunder last year in a game that the...
awful with his feet. That, like, it's like 35.
And the worst case scenario, like, if you give up a 2 with like 4 seconds to go, yeah, the Sixers could screw that up and lose that game, but you're probably not going to lose that game. And your worst case scenario, other than fouling a 3-point shooter and having it go in a Jamal Crawford, is what happened.
Yeah, they were switching everything. And so Rubio, they got McConnell switched on to Bielitsa down low. Bielitsa actually closed the game rather than Jang. And Ilyasova was guarding Rubio and then just decided that he was going going to go stand in the lane to help on God knows what that wouldn't have hurt them anyway. And Rubio just popped out to the three-point line. I thought that Towns, the play was for Towns. Initially, it looked like he was going to go one-on-one against Embiid. Looked like he was going to shoot like a fadeaway three that was pretty bottled up. Great play for a center off the dribble to audible, essentially, with 2 seconds left in the game and find a guy wide open like that. And Rubio drained the three to his credit, leaving 1.6 left. And plenty of time, though, for the Wolves to still blow it.
I alluded to this. I was amused to no end when you tweeted out the bad Wiggins defensive possession, and I knew what was coming up. But I also
I think you mean one of the many bad Wiggins.
One of the many bad, yeah. I mean, holy crap. Tonight
was notable because on some of these rebounds and shot block attempts, he was actually like jumping away from the ball. Like, he doesn't, it's so weird, right? Like, he has this 44 inch vertical. Other than when he goes to dunk, he basically like never jumps as high as he can. And maybe he just, and every once in a while going for an offensive rebound too, you'll see like a little quick burst, but he just kind of, he doesn't really bend his knees that much. He doesn't load up. Like, and when he does jump, he sort of like jumps away when he's like trying to block a shot or get a rebound. I mean, there was one hilarious play where he was right under the basket, didn't jump the first two times as the ball got tipped around. The third time he jumps and kind of jumps up towards the free throw line, even though the ball is closer to the baseline, and then the ball gets tipped off the backboard again, and it finally just goes right into his hands. He lucked into being in the perfect position. It was so odd, but in any event, I actually would say that that play was not primarily Wiggins' fault.
I would agree with you, because you need to have somebody else on the play who has the recognition of, oh crap, this is what's going on. And again, the idea of the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is a ball going into the basket and having somebody be able to catch it.
Yeah, to set up what the play was, they had Saric, a great passer, about 6'9", on the inbound. Rubio was guarding the inbounder, but then he actually sloughed off. And this whole, like, oh, all these famous plays where the inbounder wasn't being guarded, why didn't you guard the inbounder? I don't really know what the counterfactual is there, but it does seem like there's a lot of those plays. I mean, the famous one is the Grant Hill pass to Christian Laettner in the Elite Eight in 1992, where they didn't guard the inbounder. And another one was the 1972 gold medal game. Those were full court plays, though, so it's a little different. But
one point on that. It was 1.6 seconds left, so you don't have to worry as much about the inbounder getting the ball either. Just put a tall dude on.
That's a great point. Yeah, and Saric, not a guy who you're like, oh my god, this guy's some unbelievable shooter. But so what they did is they just started Covington down on the left block. Embiid was at the left elbow, and they ran a cut of looking like Covington was going to pop out to the 3-point line, and then he just curled right around Embiid at the elbow. Wiggins got stuck behind him, and he went up and had one of the easiest tip-ins you'll ever see on game point like that. But really, the big credit was Embiid, because what he did was he just started kind of pushing against Towns, and that made Towns, who was very focused on the matchup with Embiid, to just start kind of pushing back with him and focused on Embiid. He didn't want to give up position if they were going to try and then throw the ball into Embiid. And then at the last second, as Covington cut up towards the 3-point line, Embiid stuck his butt out and let Covington curl around that. So he basically screened off two guys. He was kind of engaged with Towns, although Towns didn't even move a muscle. I mean, it was really his fault. Like, you just, in an emergency situation like that, you have to be able to react and protect the rim. I mean, that's basically a back screen. If you give up a shot to Embiid, that's fine, but you cannot give up a layup. And he was so focused on his own man that he just had no reaction whatsoever. It'd be nice if Andrew Wiggins were able to stick with Covington a little bit better on that play, but a lot of guys are going to get picked off on a back screen like that. That's why you have the rules that you help on a back screen so you don't give up a layup. And I'm pretty sure that most coaches would say that I would put that more on Towns than Wiggins. It wasn't a great defensive play by Wiggins, but few defenders are going to be able to just completely deny that on their own without help.
Especially considering the lack of time that you have to really recognize what's going on, because it was a quick turn of a play, and so you just have to get into scramble mode. And so Wiggins, sure, it would have helped, but anybody also, I can't remember who was on like the far side, but that person also, once the pass goes in the air, to me, once you recognize that the pass is not going to your guy, just run the heck in, because they're not going to be able to make that play either.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough as well. I think they probably had like Stauskas on the weak side, whoever their best shooter was, so and reacting that quickly might be unrealistic. I think they had it set up pretty well where there just like wouldn't have been any help in range. All right, let's move on to, you want to do Spurs Toronto next, or Denver and and Sacramento.
Well, I think we could do Spurs-Toronto relatively quickly.
Yeah, about as quickly as the game itself ended.
You could go a couple different ways in terms of the duration of this, but the Spurs took a 12-4 lead in the first 4 minutes, just looked absolutely great, fueled by Tony Parker. And then I believe it was a 29-12 lead at the end of the first quarter.
29-18, they actually.
Oh, because they had that little push at the end, that's right.
Yeah, and they got within eight at one point early in the second on the back of Terrence Ross. And then actually, as soon as Parker came back in again, they blew out to the lead. Kawhi Leonard was unbelievable. He had 21 in the first half, which will limit the stats to that. That's the part that we watched. I knew the results already. So I feel like that's what I needed to watch. He was 8 for 11 in the first half, 5 of 6 from three, a steal, 2 blocks, really dominated, plus 31 over the course of the first half. LaMarcus plus 28. He had 17 in the first half as well. 8 for 11 from the field for him also. And while I thought their defensive performance was solid, Toronto was playing without Patrick Patterson, which hurt them to be sure. I thought the biggest takeaway here was just Toronto once again not being able to stop a really good offense. And while this has been a great offensive team up until this game, in which they only scored 82 points, I still really wonder. I mean, Tony Parker is not Tony Parker anymore, and he was just cooking Valanciunas and even Lowry, who looked a little tired in this game and was only 2 for 9, 0 of 7 on threes after that 41-point game against the Raptors. He was just cooking him, had 7 assists in the first half, getting into the lane, kicking out to shooters, Gasol and Aldridge, and Parker also 3 out of 4 from the field in the first half as well to go along with those 7 assists, and he was plus 24. Just not a guy who should be killing you in this day and age if you're the Raptors, and yet he did.
It's certainly justifiable to have a little bit of cumulative fatigue because this was their 6th road game. They've been on the trip for a long time. This is the final game on it, though it sucks for them that they have one home game and then go back out to Chicago for one and then go back and have a real extended homestand. But that doesn't explain Tony Parker playing the way that he did. Maybe everybody else. I also enjoyed that Dwayne Dedmon had a plus 20 and 3 points in like 24 minutes. He looked good in the first half moments that I watched. I did not watch any of the second half of this game because I didn't think there was any point.
Yeah, Dedmon was solid. He contributed to the defense quite well. And the other thing too for the Raps is they played in this first half, I think every minute, with two bigs on the floor and two bigs who couldn't shoot threes. It was Siakam at first. Then they went with Bebe and Valanciunas together. Then there was Bebe and Poeltl together. It really was not a combination that's going to look too good, I think, on either end. And in some ways, I think that the Spurs sucker teams into playing two bigs as well. They have these bigs who are skilled and can pass, guys like Lee, Gasol, Aldridge, Dedmon less so, but he's a quality player, and they're used to playing that way. They can get stuff out of those guys. They have these ISO scorers as well who are able to create a shot even with a little bit less spacing in Aldridge and Leonard. And so, hey, all right, fine. Great. This is awesome if you're the opposing coach. Now I can finally stay big. This is the way that I've always wanted to play. And yet, you know, you actually can't play that way against these guys. The way to play them is space out David Lee, make him guard at the three-point line, space out Pau Gasol, make him guard and pick and pop. Same thing with Aldridge. And instead, you're just playing these two bigs who aren't really going to have much of an effect the way those Spurs bigs are.
In the last 4 games of this road trip, Norman Powell played less than 10 minutes in 3 of them and played 22 minutes in the fourth. It's just weird. He only played, I think he played 7.5 or 8 minutes in this
game.
Did
not play at all in the first half.
Yeah.
And that's with Patterson out. Like, I mean, you're really that scared of David Lee that, you know, you think you're just going to get killed in the post by him? I mean, you know, it's tough for them to go small sometimes because Carroll is still just not the player that he was in Atlanta on either end. And then your only other option of anybody who can kind of play a stretch four, unless you've got Patterson, is Norman Powell, and he's 6'4", even though he's a tough guy with a big wingspan, and Ross and DeRozan are just not tough enough to play those type of roles. Still, though, it's better than Poeltl. I mean, come on. And Poeltl together with another center. There's no chance there. And that's not why they lost this game. I mean, they also, Kyle Lowry did nothing in this one. The Spurs did a great job of defending. Kawhi Leonard was incredible, made some tough shots, although the defense also, as we mentioned, was not incredible either. So there was a number of reasons there, but just in general, it's it can be rough sledding for the Raptors unless really anytime they don't have Patterson on the floor, they really don't have another good solution. He is incredibly essential to what they're doing. Even if you look at him and he seems like somewhat of a pedestrian player, they just don't play well unless he's on the floor, and he had a strained left knee, didn't play in this one.
I don't really have much more to add. Are we ready to move on to the Mike Malone non-revenge game?
Yeah, this one was really interesting. These Nuggets games have been great. We saw them last night against Golden State where they actually hung in it, mostly thanks to their offense. Jokic has been a delight to watch offensively. Looks good by the numbers defensively. I am less sanguine about how good he actually is on defense. Do you have any thoughts on that, having watched him last night and then again in this game? I've really been trying to focus on that lately, but I want to get your opinion first on really what to think of him defensively.
I think that sometimes he has the right idea, so he can figure out, you know, maybe get in the lane for a pass that that most centers wouldn't or something like that. But I don't buy him yet as a deterrent at the rim, which is an important part of his success if he's going to be the only true big on the floor. And I want to see more in terms of the solo stuff, in terms of whether he can anchor a team rebounding defensively as well. And I believe that he can be a part of successful defenses, like, let's say, above league average. I certainly believe that. But it might not be right now. It might be a year or two or three down the line.
He needs a lot of guys around him, I think, to be successful. I've heard some guys have compared him to Marc Gasol. He does not have anywhere near that level of strength, length, or even, I would say, jumping ability. Not that Marc is some amazing leaper, but
Jokic, and Marc has a rep as a communicator too.
Yeah, I think Jokic is smart. He can get there maybe on that score. And the two games that we've seen him here lately are just games where he's going to struggle in space trying to guard the Warriors. It's going to be ugly. You know, he wasn't really asked to get out on shooters, but pretty much any time his man Pachulia usually would set a screen, you're just getting a guy wide open for a three against the Warriors, and it wasn't really able to be much of a deterrent at the rim. And then here he's got to guard DeMarcus Cousins, and while he had 18 points in 28 minutes, five assists, including, by the way, to me, one of the passes of the year where he was in the post, Jamal Murray cut through the entry, cut past him, not along the baseline, but actually towards the free throw line, and then just curled around to the basket, and Jokic sort of threw a blind over the head pass, just lobbed it and let Murray run onto it like a soccer player for a layup. It was really just one of the most beautiful passes you're ever going to see from anyone, not to mention a center.
It was incredible.
Yeah, DeMarcus Cousins.
I thought I want to say with that pass, it reminded me also of like when a quarterback throws a receiver open, where you have to get
exactly like that. Yeah,
you have to get the right speed. You have to get it in the right pocket, because sometimes if you're doing that, you have to get it. You might be throwing it a little bit faster or slower than somebody.
He threw like a fade route to the corner of the end zone. It was just incredible. But nonetheless, he got his ass kicked by DeMarcus Cousins.
As many do. Cousins was great in this game. You could go in a bunch of different directions with it, but 31 points, 10 of 25 from the field, 8 of 8 from the line. One of the weird things about this game was there was only one missed free throw. The Kings were 17 of 18. The Nuggets were 13 of 13. Cousins was 8 for 8 himself from the line.
Yeah, and 3 of 7 from 3 as well, which just his willingness to take those shots and hit them well enough has opened up so much more of his game. The hilarious thing about Cousins, too, is he was just so exhausted throughout the entire game playing at altitude, and yet he was still just, like, killing him anyway. There was definitely a time where he and Nurkic were going back and forth, where he and Jokic were going back and forth. It was enjoyable, but Cousins, perhaps because the game was going well, was largely under control in this one. Had the 6 assists as well, which was excellent. And the other two stars three stars really for Sacramento, Darren Collison, 10 out of 16 from the field, 26 points for him, 7 assists. He's not really known as the greatest passer. What he was able to do, and again, this was a function of the Nuggets not really having the pick and roll defense, is he was just able to get into mid-range and just shoot. And that was really mostly what he was doing. He also had some fast break buckets a couple of times where he was able to drive right by his guy without any help. And it was just a pretty awful Nuggets defensive performance all around. They kind of just got punked. Even Aaron Aflalo got into it, played 30 minutes in this one, 8 of 11 from the field for 19 points. He actually took 4 three-pointers, which he never does. He makes them well when he shoots them, but he doesn't shoot enough of them, but he was 2 out of 4 on those. He had a couple of nice plays where he was able to just duck in on the likes of Gary Harris, shoot right over those guys. Jamal Murray was guarding him. I thought he did okay, but he got an and one on a turnaround jumper on him. So I think easily Aflalo's best game as a King. And then Kostas Koufos returning to his old Denver stomping grounds, 8 of 9 from the field, 18 points. He had that little floater working in the mid-range. But again, he was getting set up by some pretty easy straight line penetration by these Kings players, Collison in particular.
I love the amount of revenge games in this because Aflalo was also a Nugget twice. So you have that element as well. Not the biggest deal in the world. But so last night after the Warriors Nuggets game, I talked with Adam Morris about Emmanuel Mudiay's defense and how he always had this physical capability. He's a big guy. He's moves pretty well. And that he's
didn't look good in this game.
He has not been good defensively. And there were a couple times in this where he just hit the screen and died. And then Darren Collison just got an open shot. Sometimes it was a mid-ranger. Sometimes it was a above the break three. And Collison can hit those looks. You can't die on that screen.
Yeah, and the idea for Mudiay as a guy with some length is if he competes, gets over the pick, you can bother that mid-ranger from behind and let the big drop back a little bit. And Jokic is not fast enough to really get out there either. Very interesting lineups to start here. The Kings actually went with their two bigs, Koufos and Cousins to start. And then it was actually Chandler guarding Cousins for a time. They just were double teaming for a time. Chandler was hitting some threes on Cousins. Cousins was coming right back and beasting. I think Cousins had like 21 in the first half in this one. The Nuggets, it was at one point, were 14 out of 28 on threes, finished at 18 out of 38. So they got a lot of shots up, but just were not able to hit them. They are usually pretty good on the offensive glass. Kenneth Fareed didn't play in this one. It was mostly Nurkic, who I thought actually had a good game, but they only had 6 offensive rebounds. The Kings controlled the glass pretty well. And so in a 120 to 113 win for the Kings, this is not even a good Kings offensive team. And the Nuggets, yeah, they played last night in Golden State. It was hilarious, by the way. Mike Malone was kind of subtly carping about having to fly back to Denver from the West Coast to play again tonight. I'm like, you realize that half the teams that come into your building have to do that, right? Like, if you're gonna complain about that, this is like the one time that you're getting killed by that when everyone else is doing that to your advantage.
Do you want me to do a reading of some of his comments after this game?
Yes, a dramatic reading if possible.
It's a little bit too early in the morning, I guess is probably the right term for it.
Yeah,
for
that, I don't know how good your New York accent, your Mike Malone New
York
accent
is. Oh, my Mike Malone is terrible, but yeah. I'll just do it. So I'll do the first two paragraphs of it. I think that's enough. When you allow Darren Collison to get 26, Kostas Koufos to go 8 of 9 for 18 points, and then a fall off the bench, we have the worst defense in the NBA. This is the bottom line. It's embarrassing how we go out and attempt to defend every night. That's something we have to try to fix as soon as possible because it's at an all-time low right now, and that is a huge concern of mine. It's a joke right now, and we have no leadership, no veteran leadership stepping up. Don't hear anyone speaking, taking the lead. We have two young guys trying to speak up on the team, which you applaud, I assume applaud them, but we need some leadership to shine and step up.
Yeah, I wonder who those two young guys are. I guess like Mudiay and it's usually not like one of the foreign guys. So
Harris,
yeah,
and Mudiay, maybe?
Yeah, Harris and Mudiay, maybe that's it. And Harris was good in this game, by the way. He was at 15 points, 6 of 11 from the field, 3 of 4 from 3. He's got some sneaky ups, actually. Like, he'll drive to the basket off of 1 foot and you think he's just like taking off too far away, and he'll actually dunk it, like, especially if he's coming in from the right side along the baseline. Like, he'll actually get up for some dunks that'll surprise you. A few other smaller notes here that I'll get to. Willie Cauley-Stein barely played. When he did, he had one of his usual spectacular catch the ball and then just throw it off the backboard when it should be a dunk, because he just kind of loses it and he's off balance. Jamal Murray has had a couple of rough games these last two. His shot now has not been going down from three. He was 0 for 3. His only bucket was that great assist from Jokic. Didn't run a single pick and roll in this one that I saw. That's one of the things that really attracted us to him so much. Jameer Nelson, negative 14 in his 19 minutes. And I realize that he maybe has to play a little bit, but let's get Jamal Murray. Just give me one Jamal Murray pick and roll per game. You know, give me one chance for him to go with Jokic. And yeah, he was bad in this game. He drove in a couple of times, had two really ugly turnovers. It was Will Barton didn't do much either. He only had 3 points in this game. Even with Fareed out, they kind of still have too many guys. But I'd like to see Malik Beasley play a little bit too at some point. I mean, maybe not realistic when they are still in the playoff chase as they are. But I just don't think that Nelson helps them that much. I mean, part of the problem too, when the Kings went on a big run that really gave them the lead for most of the game, was Nelson just, he wasn't like spotting up far enough away from the action on the wing. And so his guy was able to help and then recover back to him. And he hit 2 out of 5 on threes, but overall really killed the spacing on a bunch of other plays. And that was really the key period in this game, was in the early in the second quarter. With Cousins out, they went on an 11-0 run to take a 46-36 lead. And then when Cousins was out again at the start of the fourth, the Nuggets weren't able to break into the lead at all either. And I think the Kings even slightly extended it. That was really a very key stretch for an ostensibly deep team like the Nuggets, and the Kings with Rudy Gay out, not really able to take advantage while Cousins was off the floor.
It was frustrating in a lot of those ways. And also the Nuggets, you mentioned Free didn't play. Wancho and Malik Beasley, I think, combined for like 2 minutes in this. I think it was just that.
Yeah, just like, I think in garbage time at the end. Yeah,
exactly. And so you think about just how many guys they have that are intriguing. And I would, not only would I love to see Jamal Murray with exactly the same starting five, but I'd like to see more Malik Beasley.
Speaking of those two guys, actually, and we'll close on this, people would wonder why a guy like Mike Miller is still in the league. He basically hasn't played all season. And I got a little window into that very early on. I got to the game early, about 5 o'clock for the 7:30 game. And there's a 3-on-3 game, Miller, Beasley, Hernan Gomez, Alonzo G, and then a couple of the Nuggets assistant coaches. I think Stephen Graham was one of them, a former NBA player. And then another guy I didn't recognize. So they're playing 3-on-3 hard. They played for like 45 minutes. I caught like the last 20 minutes of it. Wancho, they had been playing full court for a time. Then they had to switch to half court when some of the Warriors came out to start shooting. Wancho and Beasley were exhausted. And Mike Miller is still running around, still in great shape, draining threes for game point in this 3-on-3 game, you know, talking it up all the time. Like, you know, G is posting up on Beasley. He's got a size advantage. He's telling Beasley, he's going right shoulder. He's going right shoulder. Just like yelling, talking, just teaching these guys about the game, being a great vet. And then afterwards, these guys are completely exhausted. And Mike Miller is like, hey, you guys want to run some sprints with me? And makes these guys run sprints with them after they're already just like totally out of gas. And, you know, they weren't going to play. And that's how you keep those guys in shape, keep their skills sharp, teach those guys on the end of the bench to work. And that's why Mike Miller is still around.
It's great also to have those players on your bench, not as a coach, but as a player, as a peer. And it certainly does resonate differently with players. I actually talked a little bit about that with Damian Jones today, and it works. And so I totally get using a roster spot on him, even paying him the money they're paying him, because they have the money to spend and he's helping.
Yeah, especially on a team that already has so many young guys. I think it's a little different when you're on a team like the Warriors, or you're on a team like the Cavs, where number one, you're trying to compete for a championship this year. Number two, you don't really have that many young guys. And you also, if you do have young guys, you need spots for those young guys to just try and develop someone who can be a part of your roster slot, you know, where you really have probably too many of those guys. And Denver only has one. They have Mike Miller. The rest of the guys play. You know, Nelson is the other guy who would fall into that category, but he still plays as their backup point guard. All right, are we done here? Plug your Damian Jones things. I'm looking forward to listening to that once we're done here.
So I went over to the Warriors practice facility and talked with Jones after practice for 15 minutes on a lot of different things: his recovery from a torn pectoral muscle, bouncing between Santa Cruz and Oakland, what he hopes to be as a player. It was fun to do that. There is the ambient noise of the Warriors practice facility, which I think adds a little bit of character to it, but I did really enjoy that conversation. And so that is Locked On Warriors for today. You can find that in whatever podcast player you like. It's my daily Warriors podcast. And also, we'll have a new Real Jam Radio out tomorrow. I actually don't know which one it's going to be, because I recorded with Ben Golliver today, and I'm recording another one tomorrow. I'm keeping the Real Jam Radio tradition of not saying who my guest is until it's recorded. And I legitimately don't know which one of them I'm going to put out.
All right, don't forget about following us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. The Twitter NBA show will be back on Thursday night this week. And I want to remind you too, if you want to get a notification of that instead of having to just find it when I tweet it out, if you go into the Twitter mobile app, there's a little bell next to my name at Nate Duncan NBA, and you can click on a drop down menu that will alert you when the user goes to live video. So whenever I do that, and I only really do that for the Twitter NBA show at this point, so it won't be too much spam. If you want to listen to it live, you can do that. Get in on Periscope to ask some questions, which we take during both the halftime shows and the show afterwards. We're actually going to do, I think, at least some of our awards for the second month of the season. So that's always a fun one. That'll get some good comments. And if you want to add them and get them answered, go for it. We really appreciate the interaction on that show. And if you can't watch it live, then we will be doing a later cast on Dunked On as well. All right, that's enough plugging for 2:41 a.m. We will talk to you all next time. Till then.